Good afternoon to you. My name is Oliver Norville, and right now it is time for Mental Health Matters. And of course, we have your host, Tessa Chatterton-Shaw. Good afternoon to you, ma'am. How are you doing today? You might have to unmute your mic, see if that works. Okay, Tessa's just getting ready to join us. Also, I want to say good afternoon to her guest, Dr. Sharon Harvey. Hi, Tessa, how are you doing today?
Because my volume is to the maximum.
I got you covered. We can hear you loud and clear now. Good afternoon.
Right. So I want to wish everyone, all Barbadians, a blessed and happy Easter in the midst of a pandemic. But we must remember that God is among us at this time. And I just want to say how we must remember also his resurrection for us. It is a difficult time. Just let me say, I noted with interest that you just had a program on mental health, but it was focusing more on the adolescent population, which is interesting. I think that was part of Paradox.
Yes, ma'am.
And I need to highlight something which I also found very interesting, and I would like to encourage Barbadians to buy this. Or this is Better Health. That was, of course, by the Nation Group, same OCM, under which Starcom Network falls. But there's a fantastic article on bipolar disorder. It's entitled Bipolar Disorder More Than Mood Swings. So I just want to bring that to the public's attention quickly, because as I said, mental health, there are many mental health matters, but also our individual mental health matters. So as we continue on this journey to what I call peeling the layers of an onion that is very complex, in a sort of psychiatry being an inexact or an imprecise discipline, we're going to talk today about some other issues. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Sharon Harvey. I could say a lot of things about Dr. Harvey, but what is most important is that, lots of good things, by the way, but Dr. Sharon Harvey is a psychiatrist who completed her medical training at the University of the West Indies, followed by postgraduate studies in psychiatry in London, England, where she obtained the membership of the Royal College of Psychiatrists in 1986. On return to Barbados, she worked initially as a consultant at the psychiatric and the Queen Elizabeth Hospitals. And since October 1999, she has worked mainly in private practice. She is an associate lecturer with the University of the West Indies and formerly a committee member of the World Psychiatric Association. So she comes to us today with a wealth of knowledge. So welcome, Dr. Harvey.
Right, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes. I just, before I ask my first question, I just want to say to callers or to listeners that I want to manage the time a little more carefully to allow callers to call in towards the final, well, I'll be guided by Oliver towards the final 10 to 15 minutes of the program. I've given you two musical selections, so you can decide, Oliver, when to intersperse or discourse with those.
Well, I am at your command, ma'am. It's when you're ready, I shall play them.
Okay. Okay, so Dr. Harvey.
Right.
Last week with Dr. June Price Humphrey, we merely scratched the surface of a very complex, multifaceted area of medicine.
Right.
And it has much to do with the brain.
Yes.
And that's something that I think we don't pay a lot of importance to, the health of our brain and how things impact our brain.
Right.
Whether what we consume, what we eat, our sleeping patterns, but more importantly, mental illnesses and
yes.
the need to reach a state of good mental wellness.
Right.
Particularly at this time. So my first question to you is, how do psychiatrists arrive at a diagnosis or diagnoses?
Well, it's a process because it's not just, you know, jump on a thought and say, okay, that's a diagnosis. So the process involved obviously seeing the patient and taking a history. And a history of two sorts. You want to get a history of what's the urgent problem that has brought the person to attention or to seeking assistance. And so we want to find out, you know, when did it start? How did it start? Are there any associated happenings with this, the particular symptom that they see as problematic? And so we follow that through. The other part of the history would be getting some background information on family, you know, how many siblings, where they in the listing of siblings, are the parents still alive or deceased, and then getting some idea of their childhood history to see whether there were any traumatic events or important events that occurred both through childhood and into adolescence. And then get an idea of their whether they did further study or whether they went into work, their work history, past medical history, any substance abuse history, and past psychiatric history. Then it's looking at, now the person is in front of you, I mean, what is one observing? What's the mood like as they're speaking? Is the speech, you know, sort of logical and sequential? Is the person speaking louder than would be expected? You know, what's their demeanor? How are they dressed? And after pulling all of these together, then we can pick out what seem to be the salient symptoms. And then we're guided by a classification of mental disorders. One most commonly used is the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders.
Known as the DSM.
Yes, and it's now in its fifth edition. So we refer to the DSM-5. And correct. So this pulls categories of symptoms together, which allow for, okay, that grouping is most likely that diagnosis, this grouping is most likely this diagnosis.
Right.
But important to know that it's a guide. I mean, one needs one's clinical training and acumen to actually decide on the diagnosis. And why I'm stressing that is I know sometimes persons get the listing, the criteria, say off the internet and say, okay, tick, 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 I tick all of these, therefore I have that condition.
Right.
And it's a reminder that no, it's not a checklist. Yeah. One has to have done the history and mental state examination and pulling it together in a contextual framework to decide on what would be the most likely diagnosis.
Yeah.
And also
I was going to say, as I listen to you, I'm thinking, you have to be very focused on that patient in front of you.
Yes.
Not just background, family information, lifestyle, work, but also you're observing body language and speech and
yes.
whether they're in a state of calmness or yes. or irritability.
Absolutely. And also recognizing, I mean, and I think on the whole, patients do very well. I mean, walking into a setting with someone you've not met before, in a setting you may not have been in before, and then you're supposed to, you know, talk about yourself and all that's happened. And so sometimes it may not be possible to get all of that in one session, because you have to build up a sense of interaction and rapport with the patient, and it may take two or more sessions, you know, to get more of a rounded picture in order to be able to come to the most likely diagnosis. So yes, it's a process.
Right. I just want to say that, you know, not only are we here to educate and enlighten and to raise the awareness, which is has certainly been heightened during this COVID-19 right. pandemic. But the other issue is, I've heard too often people say the psychiatrists, or they would even say the shrink, which we need to stop using that language, doesn't know what he or she's talking about, or that's a misdiagnosis. You know, you don't have you're not suffering from chronic depression. You don't have bipolar. You don't have schizoaffective disorder. You know, so and then the patient whom or the client who may not have listened or captured all that you've said then starts to think about, well, do I really fill this prescription out, you know?
Yes, right. Yeah, I think that, yeah, persons often aren't aware that all of this sort of process has kind of gone into it. And I think they get caught up with the, okay, it's these checklist of symptoms. I don't fit into that checklist, therefore I don't have the condition. Because a checklist works in two ways. Okay, it's a guide if a certain number of symptoms are present, it's likely the person has that condition. But we must also remember that sometimes the persons may not fit the criteria for a condition, but are in a state of distress. So we, you know, we might not be able to say a person absolutely fits this diagnosis, but it's clear they're in a state of distress and it's clear that they need assistance. Because something, let's say, something like bereavement. Now, bereavement is not a mental disorder. It's not a psychiatric disorder. But one can be in a very, you know, significant state of distress and may need some assistance. So we can still offer assistance, but not saying that the person has a psychiatric condition, because it's not. I mean, it's a normal, unexpected reaction to the loss of someone close to you.
Yeah, and I was, as you said that, I was thinking that the whole grieving process differs for each individual. Yes. I mean, I still miss my grandparents. I'm not depressed about it or sad about
right.
it.
Right.
But I still miss my grandparents from 1994 and 1996. And so does my mother.
Yes.
If I could be very personal. So I think there are, as you were saying, significant life events, traumatic events. And sometimes we do not feel, correct me if I'm wrong, we do not necessarily feel the impact of that right away.
Yes,
we might start feeling it 6 months down the road.
Yes, because if we think about how the mind, not sorry, the brain, but the mind, the way we think, sometimes if something is very traumatic, almost to protect us, the brain can sort of, you know, cut that down, sort of put it, what we call repress it, sort of put that on the back burner, because otherwise you might just, you know, collapse and not be able to move another foot. But it's still there to be dealt with. It hasn't gone anywhere. So you may find that, yes, when, although the person seems to have dealt with this situation, it's 3 months, 6 months, 2 years, 5 years down the road, that then it resurfaces and still sort of needs to be dealt with.
Right. So let's say, you know, Mary Jane comes to you and you make a diagnosis. She's an adult, married woman with two or three children. Do you invite her husband in, her children? You have made a diagnosis and she has come to terms with it.
Right.
You said it was a process. How do you engage other relatives to be supportive?
Okay. Well, in principle, Remember I said the part of the process of making a diagnosis was gathering information. So in principle, it would be good to have information from other persons who are also interacting with the patient. But there is the issue of confidentiality. I mean, because you said an adult. And so I have to observe confidentiality. I mean, so I can say it would be useful if it was possible to speak to other persons. But I can only do that if the patient gives permission and is okay with me doing that. Because it could be helpful, I agree, to get more information. But yes, the person, once they're an adult, would have to give permission for that. And they may decide not to give permission. I mean, they don't have to give permission. So then you deal with what's available.
All right. After I'll ask this next question, I'm going to ask Oliver to play Fall on Me. But okay, after this question, because you triggered a thought. The whole question of confidentiality in a small society is so important.
Yes.
So I want you to address that and juxtaposition it with what we call duty of care. Like, you know that someone, you are aware that someone is having suicidal thoughts, or they have a diagnosis, but they're not compliant with their medication. You kind of walk a fine line. Right. Let's say that we spoke about Mary Jane, or I can't remember what name I used, but then her husband, yes, you have met him, but then he realizes something bizarre is going on. You know, she seems to be at risk to herself, or maybe at risk to others.
Right.
How do we navigate that?
Well, in the situation where that is met, where the person is either at immediate risk to themselves, or they're having thoughts of harming someone else, or even in a situation where they're clearly ill and that illness is deteriorating rapidly, that we know that soon one of those conditions would happen, they may not be able to continue to look after themselves, then that's where the Mental Health Act comes in, because it then allows for that person to be seen as an emergency by a mental health officer. And that assessment can determine whether the person in fact does need to be taken to treatment, even though they may be against that idea. But if there is imminent danger to themselves or others, yes, then the Mental Health Act comes into play at that point.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying that. So just let's listen to a very special selection, Fall on Me, which I think I love classical music, but it also speaks to the support that people with mental health challenges require, by Andrea Bocelli and his son, Matteo Bocelli.
Right, very good.
Okay. We have to mute our mics.
Sooner or later the lights up above will come down in circles and God made a love. But I don't know what's right for me, I cannot see straight. I've been here too long and I don't wanna wait for it. Fly like a cannonball straight to my soul, tear me to pieces and make me feel whole. I'm willing to fight for it and carry this weight, but with every step I keep questioning what is true. Fall on me with open arms. Fall on me from where you are. Fall Sempre guidarti saprà, tu non arrenderti, attento a non perderti, e il tuo passato avrà senso per te. Vorrei che credessi in te stesso, ma sì, in ogni passo che muoverai qui, è un viaggio infinito, sorriderò se nel tempo che fugge mi porti con te.
Beautiful music of Andrea and Matteo Bocelli.
I love the combination of father and son. I love the concept of falling on me. And I also love the Italian. I don't speak it, but I understand it, believe it or not. Dr. Harvey, just to continue our conversation.
Right.
What are the most common types of mental illness seen in your practice here in Barbados? Is there a common thread, or you would say it's a mixed bag?
Well, it's mixed. And since I am involved in an outpatient setting, it sort of skews things. Obviously, it'd be a little different from what someone in a hospital setting or in an outpatient of a hospital may see. The most common conditions would be like anxiety, depression, sort of the mood disorders, including bipolar disorder as well. Some substance use disorders, more likely more alcohol than otherwise. And then sort of stress-related things. Some post-traumatic stress disorder, maybe from having been in an accident or an assault of some kind. And then there are the things that, like I mentioned with the example of bereavement, that can't be really categorized as being in a disorder, but the persons are in in distress, such as like relationship difficulties, or maybe work-related stress, or adjusting. Sometimes persons leaving school and adjusting to the university environment. So those sort of adjustment, transitional difficulties. So quite a lot is seen in that sort of area.
That brings me to another point, which I didn't intend to ask, but I will ask it. Psychiatrists and psychologists also need to take care of themselves, not so.
Yes, that's absolutely.
How do you shut off at the end of the day,
right,
with all of these problems being presented to you?
Right. So we have to sort of practice what we preach, and what we preach are things like, you know, exercise, having an activity where your mind needs to be present. So if you're playing an instrument, or even learning to play an instrument, or dance and learning a choreography, I mean, you can't be doing that and thinking about something else at the same time. You have to be present. So having activities that are sort of separate from work, and certainly some kind of physical activity in there, because when we exercise, there are actually chemicals that go to the brain and help the brain, almost like nutrients for the brain. So there's a direct relationship between exercise and the brain. So we have to practice the same things that we encourage our patients.
Yeah.
And have downtime as well.
Yeah, I've often given that a lot of thought. And having said that, I find, based on my experience and my knowledge, sometimes it's very difficult to get help after hours, like after 4:30. And people are often in crisis on after, like, night, right, late in the night, after hours, on holidays, like weekends, right, like this weekend, right, Christmas, right, times. You know, whether it's a mental health challenge, whether it's substance abuse. So where do we turn? Where do we turn after hours when, you know, private practices are closed, or even polyclinics might be closed?
Right. Well, the same sort of emergency services that are available for medical conditions as well. So it would be accident and emergency at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, or if specifically a mental health challenge, then one can contact the assessment unit at the psychiatric hospital, and they can guide. I mean, if it does seem like it's someone that needs urgent admission, then they can advise on how to go about that, or whether the person needs to be assessed by a community psychiatric nurse who can go to the person's home to do the assessment and see what's required. But those would be the main routes. I mean, for things like sort of someone having a panic attack, then the sort of private emergency clinics, you know, one can also go there. And there's also the emergency service that can come to one's home. So they can also be used, because then they can refer on if it's something that they can't deal with directly.
Okay. The point that you mentioned, I think it's called the Barbados Psychiatric Hospital, which is still highly stigmatized. So are you, and I want to, again, I want us to change our language from Jenkins, the mental, Black Rock, you know, it's the Barbados Psychiatric Hospital, just like we say the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. So are you saying to me, let's say someone is self-mutilating, which is cutting themselves, are you saying to me then that if that individual's family recognizes that they are self-mutilating, you can go to the psychiatric hospital and get help right away?
Well, I suggest.
I mean, after assessment.
Yeah, calling. Yes, yes. Or through the Queen Elizabeth Hospital and the Accident and Emergency Department, because there is a psychiatric unit at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, and there would be psychiatrists on call who would can be called to assess the situation.
I just have to be very frank here, and not that I really want to be critical, but sometimes the wait at the in accident and emergency, I do not get the sense that a patient presenting with, let's say, suicidal thoughts and ideations is considered a priority when you have somebody with a gunshot wound, for example.
Well, yeah, I mean, so I can't speak for the as an emergency and how they would organize their triage.
Right.
But you know, that is the emergency department for mental health emergencies as well as medical emergencies. So one can access care there.
Okay. You mentioned bipolar earlier, and again, I refer to the recent publication of Better Health, which
right.
focuses 2 pages on what is bipolar disorder. I know many people who have bipolar disorder. Can you distinguish between bipolar 1 and bipolar 2? Because there's a difference.
Well, the main distinction is that bipolar 1, the person has had at least one episode of what we call a full manic episode, meaning that they are in a sort of hyper-aroused state and have been for at least up to a week. So perhaps we should start by saying the reason it's bipolar is that these are persons who can present in a manic or hyper-aroused state and at other times may present in a, with depression. So in bipolar 1, the main thing is that someone who has had an identified full manic episode. With bipolar 2, it's where the person has not had what we call a full-blown manic episode, but what we call a hypomanic episode. So a few notches down that has been only for like a few days. And they have depression as well. So it's really the level of the sort of the manic condition that determines whether it goes into bipolar 1 or bipolar 2.
So are you just seeing it as a spectrum then? Is it a spectrum, one more severe than the other?
Well, it's difficult to say in terms of severity, because the person with bipolar 1 or even bipolar 2 who has the hypomanic episode might have a very severe and concerning depression. So they might still have a very severe illness. It gives an idea as to really how severe the manic episode is in the two conditions. And remember I was saying about the checklists,
right?
And that we mustn't do the DSM-5 as a checklist. I know that many, celebrities have kind of come out and said that they're bipolar. Sure. I find we have to be a little bit careful because it's now become a sort of fashionable term, I'm finding. And so persons are, you know, we have to be careful that they don't just do the checklist and then feel that they're bipolar, because that could go either way. You know, I'm bipolar. Let me go check it out. Let me go see someone.
Yeah.
Or I could say, oh my gosh, I'm bipolar. This is terrible. This is the end of the world, you know, and with other more negative consequences. So
yeah.
We have to be careful of that checklist.
Yes.
Approach.
I just want to say something, and I think I can do this publicly, because the very special lady was the first person that I'm aware of who came out publicly and said she had bipolar disorder, and that is former lecturer at the University of the West Indies, I believe in English literature, Margaret Gill.
Yes.
I just want to say hello to Margaret. I salute her for being so brave and so bold, but I would never forget it. Because for me, opening up and disclosing that was a very powerful moment for, I think it should have been for all of us. But too often, we also in casual conversation say, he bipolar, man, bipolar.
Yeah.
And as you're saying, it could go either way. We can also be very unkind to others.
Yes.
In tossing around these terms.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Right. And especially,
Go ahead.
No, I was just going back to something you'd raised earlier, the fact that we're in a small society, that doesn't help with the sort of stigma.
Of course.
Associated. Because then many persons are sort of hearing that.
Well, if there's one thing that I want to achieve through this 12-week journey is that we have that permission to state how we're feeling, to whether it's trauma from a short-term problem that causes us to be depressed, or we're depressed because of a past traumatic event or unresolved issues. We need to release and give ourselves permission to say, this is how I'm feeling and I need help.
Yes. Well, I think that's a very important word, permission. Because, I mean, it's important to give yourself permission, but I find often it's when the person has reached sort of treatment that a big part of my job is giving them permission that it's okay. I mean, the same way that persons are allowed to have medical conditions and no one's, you know, sort of points a finger, you know, you give yourself permission. I mean, as we were talking about the brain earlier, the brain is another organ in the body. It's not always going to work according to plan.
Correct.
You know, so we have to, you know, see it in that context. Yeah.
It's one of the most complex organs.
Absolutely. Yes.
Sometimes I consider the amount of information that we retain, passwords, PIN numbers, basic details that are stored in the crevices of our brain.
Yes.
And it's amazing what the brain does.
Yes.
It's miraculous, actually.
Right.
I just want listeners to know that we are going to 4:30, right, Oliver, because we had a glitch at the start.
So yes, ma'am, we are. And I just want to let you know, we have had some calls. And there's one or two questions from the WhatsApp chat. So when you're ready, I can read them for you. And as soon as you're ready to take the calls, I guess in about 50 minutes or so, we can start to have some engagement with the listeners right here on Voice of Barbados.
Definitely. I want to just ask Dr. Harvey, what is the relationship between a psychiatrist and a psychologist?
Okay.
And, you know, some people are confused. I know one can prescribe medication and one cannot.
Okay.
But walk us through that.
All right. Okay. Yes. I mean, it's because they sound very similar. So the fundamental difference is that a psychiatrist is a fully trained medical doctor. So he's done the full training in medical school, internship, is a registered medical practitioner, who has then gone on to specialize in psychiatry. So they're a medical doctor, and that's where the writing of prescriptions and so on would come. And I guess an understanding of sort of medical other medical conditions. A psychologist usually would have done a bachelor's degree in psychology and then a master's or PhD in psychology itself, clinical psychology or some similar field. So there is quite a bit of overlap in terms of some of the talking therapies, but we often work together as a team, because psychologists are more trained in what we call sort of like interview instruments or questionnaires to tease out maybe aspects of personality, whether the person has a learning disability or some other sort of cognitive difficulty. But we can sometimes have patients in common, because I may see a patient who presents in a very depressed state, I mean, perhaps barely speaking, and they need sort of urgent attention and get started with medication. As they have improved, it may become clear that, you know, there are issues from childhood that are unresolved, or, you know, other maybe relationship issues. And I may refer that person on to a psychologist for that sort of behavioral psychological assistance. Conversely, someone may go to a psychologist, and in their assessment, they realize, you know, I can't start working with this person yet because the severity of their condition, they will probably need to get started with medication. So they may refer to a psychiatrist to get that process started. And so it might be either or we sometimes have patients in common that we're seeing for different aspects.
But it is important for the two to work together.
Because we're really part of, it's really a multidisciplinary team in an ideal setting that can assist a patient. So they would be the psychiatrist, the psychologist, maybe a social worker to deal with the domestic issues, maybe an occupational therapist to, you know, get back to functioning, and the nurse as well, who may also do community visits. So it's really, in an ideal setting, we would have a multidisciplinary team that consists of these. Yes. Okay.
Okay. So one last point.
Okay.
You talked about the medical training. What about a doctor of psychology, that someone now with a PhD?
Can
they prescribe medication?
No, because their doctorate would be a PhD, not a medical doctor. So they would be called doctor in the same way that a lawyer who has done a PhD would be called doctor, or any field.
Okay.
So yes, they are a doctor, but they're not a medical doctor.
Okay, understood. So what we're gonna do now is play my next selection, Ave Maria by Sarah Brightman. And after that, we will open the invite callers and WhatsAppers to ask their questions.
Oh,
Music from Sarah Brightman. It's now 30 minutes after 4 o'clock. Okay, Mrs. Shaw, I have a question here from the WhatsApp chat. And just to let everybody know, the number to call is 434-1790. The WhatsApp number is 266-4862. That's 266-4862. I have a question here. It is, can you please explain what is a chemical imbalance?
Dr. Harvey?
Right, okay. All right, so this is a term that is used to sort of generally explain what is going on in the brain. So in what the conditions that we call mental disorders, depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia, it's felt that what causes the symptoms is at the level where brain cells communicate, because they don't communicate by touching. There's a little space, and in fact, chemicals trickle out of one, trickle across, attach to the other, and the message then continues on. So it's electrical to chemical to electrical, and on goes the impulse. And it's felt in that space, which we call the synapse, that the difficulties may be occurring so that the message doesn't get through effectively. I mean, I know many persons as a child may have played the game where you go in a circle, you whisper something to one person, they whisper, and then when the message comes back, it's completely altered. So it's almost like that at each synapse. If the message isn't being passed correctly, then you get a faulty signal going through. And so it's there are certain chemicals in that synapse. I mean, and I think persons sometimes hear dopamine, serotonin as the more common ones. And it's not really so much an imbalance. It is that either the nerve that's supposed to be releasing the chemicals is somehow not releasing them as they should, or it might be that the nerve that's supposed to be receiving them is not as sensitive or too sensitive. But a general way of thinking about it is as a chemical imbalance. So it's a general term to try to explain what may be happening.
Okay, thank you for that. Oliver, I believe you have some callers.
Yes, we have some callers on the line.
Good afternoon.
Hi, good evening.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Hello, good evening. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
I recognize that voice.
Okay.
Happy Easter to everyone first.
Thank you.
I have a few questions. What are crazy pills and what are they called? That's number one. How are you tested for bipolar disorder? That's my number two question. Hello?
Yes, I'm hearing you.
We're here.
Okay. And is there a DNA test for mental health?
Okay. All right. Okay. So let's start with the first one, because I have no idea what crazy pills are, but I'm assuming that you're maybe referring to medication that may be given to treat a mental disorder. I mean, but we don't use words like crazy anymore. So in the same way, I mean, psychiatry is a branch of medicine. So in the same way that if someone has diabetes, then they take medication for their condition. If they have hypertension, they take medication for their condition. In the same way with psychiatric disorders, persons, depending on the level of severity, may need to take medication to assist with their condition. Not every situation requires medication, as we've spoken about the talking therapies as well. But there are some times when it's important to take medication in order to bring about an alleviation of the condition, because you don't want to stay depressed for like a whole year. You may, because irreversible things may happen in that time. You may lose your job, it affects relationships. And so you really want to get out of that place of darkness as soon as possible, and medication can help that. So I'm not sure if I've answered that question.
I've never heard of crazy pills.
Okay. So on to bipolar disorder. As we said, that it's a general condition, meaning the person has both episodes of depression as well as episodes of being hyper aroused and maybe not sleeping lots of IVs. And the principle of diagnosis would be back to taking the history, because I mean, if I just suddenly and here in the session felt, oh gosh, I'm having a good time here, and I keep that feeling going, you know, off until the evening and tomorrow, then I wouldn't be diagnosed as bipolar, because it's only lasted probably less than 24 hours. So that's where we use the diagnostic criteria to give us some guidance. So it has to be ongoing for 4 days a week, and you know, quite consistently, because otherwise we would all, you know, just be going around like flatlined, because we wouldn't dare show, you know, that we're really happy, or we wouldn't dare be depressed, because there's something that I call normal misery. I mean, we don't go through a day, you know, in a flat mood. We are allowed to feel a bit miserable from time to time, but that's not an illness. You know, we don't say, okay, you now have depression because you've been miserable for all of, you know, half a day. It has to be ongoing, you know, for at least a couple of weeks and month more.
All right, Dr. Murray, I don't mean to rush you, but tells me we have two callers waiting.
Okay.
Want to ask, Miss Undecided, I believe, asked a third question about DNA.
Well, that's not available at the present. I mean, the neuroscientists are doing all the research, but as of, you know, today, we don't have that as a diagnostic tool.
Okay, let's go straight to the other caller. Good afternoon to you. You're on Voice of Barbados.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Good afternoon,
everyone. Miss Jonathan Shaw, I'm very glad that you brought up this show about mental health and people's emotions. I just want to say thank you for it, and thank you for bringing in the goodly doctor. There are persons out there who tend to bully and, you know, try to make sport at others, and when you have they don't understand your emotions, because everyone feel that you well, as Isaiah say, your thoughts are not my thoughts, not my ways yours. And if you have to put down your foot, you become the worst enemy. I would like you to speak on people's emotions and why that if people tend to do people things and they ask to limit what they are doing, or people bullying people, why they should stop? Because when you have to speak on it, or you have to put a stand to it, you become the worst thing out. So I'm glad that Miss Shaw brought up this, and she brought it up at a good time. Thank you very much.
Right, you're welcome. Yes, so it's, as we were saying before, with permission, that we will have varying emotions. Sometimes we'll be happy, sometimes we'll be sad. Sometimes we will be angry, and it's acknowledging that in the same way that we acknowledge those emotions in ourselves, we also have to recognize that they can occur in other persons, and sort of not put them down because they're showing an emotion. Because anger is a difficult one, but it's a normal emotion. Or what we have to do is to recognize that when we're angry, we have choices as to how we behave, but anger itself, you know, is an allowable emotion, because there are times when we will have that feeling.
I want to thank the caller for expressing her gratitude, but I just was thinking that, you know, we may decide to withdraw. We may be going through something, not that we are mentally ill or have a diagnosis, but for our own peace of mind, we might decide to withdraw from a particular group or from a particular activity. But then we're seen as, well, what's wrong with her? What's wrong with him? But we might just decide to to seek solace and to withdraw from an activity, to regain strength and to regain our ability to function. Not so?
Yes, that's right.
And some people may see that in a negative light as opposed to self-care.
Self-care, yes.
Okay. Oliver, are there other?
Yes, ma'am. We have a young man on the line who's been waiting for quite a while. Good evening to you, sir.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, nice program.
Thank you.
Now, my question is this. A person who likes seeing a lot of rubbish and things wrong and can't get rid of rubbish, is that a mental state of being? Is that a mental sickness? You know, a person that who can't let rubbish go out of their sight. Something about this rubbish that they enjoy seeing, or probably it means a lot to them. What is the name of that sickness, mental sickness, FAS?
Sorry, caller, are you saying rubbish? I'm not
rubbish.
Sure.
Yeah, rubbish, I think.
Yeah, rubbish. Okay. I mean, things that people may think are no use to them. They themselves believe that those things mean something to them.
Yes. Well, I mean, the other thing with mental illness and conditions is that it's not just at a point in time. I mean, it's part of a range. And so we all, I think, even as I look around the room where I am, I mean, there's stuff that I have that probably could be thrown away, but, you know, you're keeping it for sentimental reasons or other reasons. But I can still at least walk into the room. There's still space to walk into the room. If it was that I was so full of stuff that I couldn't even walk into the room, and then I couldn't, you know, no, I couldn't have guests over because they couldn't get into the kitchen or into the living room, then that certainly is at a level now where it's affecting your ability to interact socially. So again, it's degree. And sometimes even in psychiatry, it's difficult to decide, okay, when is this person, you know, just gathering stuff together for nostalgic reasons? And when is it at the point now where we're saying that they have some level of hoarding that's now problematic and they need some assistance? So, I mean, the guideline is if it's causing a disruption to your, you know, social or occupational functioning, or even, you know, the health inspectors might be concerned that, you know, this is now a safety, health and safety hazard. If it's at that point, then it certainly needs to be addressed because the person may have some kind of hoarding issue.
Okay, so
I'm
thank
not
you.
Sure if that,
thank
okay.
you.
Oliver, I have a question, but I don't know if you have more callers, but there's a question from a WhatsApper. So the person asks, do psychiatrists or psychologists practice hypnosis here in Barbados? And is that used as a form of treatment or therapy?
Okay, well, as far as I'm aware, no psychiatrists practice hypnosis. I remember in my training, it was recognized that hypnosis used to be sort of part of sort of the talking therapies, but it was found that it wasn't very long, it didn't have a long-lasting effect for some things. So I know persons use it with like smoking cessation and so on. But if it's someone presenting with a depression, then you may be able to get them hypnotically to feel better, but it wasn't very robust, and they probably would have slipped into depression. Whether there are any psychologists in Barbados who practice hypnosis, I am not entirely sure. I mean, I know that there are some therapists and counselors who are hypnotherapists, and they have that as a field that they're involved in. So it is available in Barbados. It's just it's difficult for me to be precise because hypnosis is really a form of deep relaxation, and relaxation is an important part of maintaining good mental health as well.
I believe I stand to be corrected, but I believe that would fall into the realm of alternative medicine and things like, yes, and, like acupuncture, yes, and especially for, well, people.
Yes. I mean, although again, it's a blurred area. I mean, acupuncture has been found useful in some areas of general medicine and in psychiatry. So we're getting, it's, yeah, the edges are a little bit blurred for some of the things.
Okay. Oliver, how are we doing for time? And are there more callers?
We're just about 1 minute away from closing.
Okay.
So we can start wrapping.
Really? Okay. So I just want to make one announcement. Next week's guest is Dr. Enya Mon. She is also a psychiatrist. She is president of the Barbados Association of Psychiatrists. And we are going to be focusing on a very difficult subject matter, but one that does need to be addressed, and that is suicide. This past week, there was one in Barbados, but I just want to inform listeners that that is what we will be focusing on. Dr. Harvey, I wish to thank you sincerely for sharing your wealth of knowledge with us, your vast expertise, and I wish you and your family a continued Easter season and all the best in your practice. And okay.
Thanks very much for having me.
I really also appreciated the callers and the WhatsAppers. And we continue on this journey. Not only will we have psychiatrists, but there will be psychologists and social workers as we proceed on this journey. Mental health matters. So Oliver, as we close, if we could hear O Sole Mio, or there's no time.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. We do have Sunday Jazz coming up though.
Oh, wow. Okay. So a pleasant good afternoon to everyone. I hope you enjoy the show. And next week, same time at 3 o'clock, Oliver.
Yes, ma'am.
Is it 3 or 3:15?
We will confirm that this week, and we will announce it if it'll be 3 or 3:15 sometime in the week.
Yeah. Actually, next week we have a sponsor. Just let me say Lewis Drug Mart. Big up to Mr. David Lewis. So the next two programs will be sponsored by Lewis Drug Mart in Rockley. Good afternoon to everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, Oliver. Thank you, Dr. Harvey.
Thank you, Tom. Good evening.
Okay. Bye.